Luke Groskin here. I produce videos for Science Friday, and we want you to watch them. Did you know that you can subscribe to our science videos? That's right, just like the podcast you're listening to now, you can subscribe to get a weekly dose of Science Friday on video. Just head over to youtube.com/scifry. That's youtube.com/scifry, and click the subscribe button. It's that easy. Thanks for listening. Now on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Later this hour, our ode to the transcendence, the irrationality of our favorite constant, pi, on this Pi Day's eve. But first, a year ago this month, a little algorithm broke some big news. Just minutes after a magnitude 4.4 earthquake rocked Los Angeles, the LA Times had an article up on its website. The author was a computer program dubbed QuakeBot, created by one of the newspaper's editors, a human named Ken Schwenke. In the year since QuakeBot's big scoop, opportunities to read algorithm-penned news stories have multiplied. If you follow financial or sports news, well, chances are you've read a computer-generated story without even realizing it. Here to talk about the proliferation of bot journalists is human journalist Will Oremus. He's a senior technology writer at Slate, and he joins me now in our New York studios. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks. And let me say at the outset, I really want to thank you for having me on instead of one of those robot journalists that's trying to steal my job. That was really decent of you.
As long as they don't have robot talk show hosts, I'm just fine with it. You know, we're also going to take your calls at 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. Are you worried about bots writing news? You can give us a call. So what are bots writing these days, Will?
One of the most visible things that bots are writing instead of humans now are corporate earnings reports. So when Disney or Apple comes out with their first quarter earnings, the first reports you're going to see about it are not going to be written by humans. They're going to be written by these bots. In this case, it's a company called Automated Insights. It's a startup based in Durham, North Carolina. It was recently acquired, actually. But they will come out way faster than any human could write this. And they'll say something like, Disney reported first quarter earnings up 33% from last year, beating analysts' estimates. It'll be very dry, but you might mistake it for a human-written earnings report, if only one written by a human who's been trained to write in a very dry style.
Well, but that's the thing. I've written those reports myself in the past, and I have to say, it's not the most exciting work. Maybe robots can do it, right?
Yeah, in fact, they really can. They can do it, and not only can they do it, but they can do it really fast. They can write about 2,000 of these in a second, if you ask them to. And so they get the news out there. They get it out accurately. They get it out quickly. It's very cheap. And then what you do is if you want some more context, if you want a little more depth to the story, if it's a company people really care about, like Disney is, the Associated Press will have its human journalists go back in, do a write-through, and maybe instead of just leading with the dry facts and figures, they'll lead with, it was a magical first quarter for Disney.
We'll say, and we'll be talking a little bit more later on the show about adding some flourishes to this work. But in terms of journalism, boss, I mean, how exactly do they work? How do they get these stories out so fast?
Well, it's interesting. They actually work surprisingly similar to how human journalists work, at least at the most basic level. So they start with a data set. They start with, let's call it a spreadsheet. So Zacks Investment Research provides the data for these earnings reports that are put out by Automated Insights on the Associated Press wire. The spreadsheet comes in, and then some algorithms have been trained to look through the spreadsheet and find the most interesting tidbits. They've been trained that, you know, if earnings are up 33% from a year ago this quarter, that's a big deal. Let's lead with that. Mm-hmm. And then there are also these human meta writers, some of the companies call them. They're the people who say, well, once you find these insights, here's how you're going to turn that into a narrative frame. Here's how you're going to turn it into a lead and a story. So if the big story is that the earnings are up 33%, let's lead with that, and then let's structure the story as a story about a big jump in earnings, and then there'll be sort of a template for that, and you'll fit in the rest of the relevant facts and figures as needed, maybe in sort of an inverted pyramid style.
So as to not think of this as so scary, you've even called this a type of data visualization tool, not necessarily thinking about it like writing a story like a reporter would, but maybe something that you'd see that's data visualization. That's a different way of thinking about it, certainly.
Yeah, you know, we call these robot journalists because it's kind of fun to say. People know what you're talking about when you say robot journalists. In fact, they're not really either robots or journalists. Robots are things that operate in the world. They're machines. These are software agents. They're software programs. They're not, a clunky Jetson-style robot sitting down at a computer and typing. I think everybody knows that, but all the same, those are the pictures you get with these stories about the robot journalists. The thing that's that's different about what humans can do versus the robots is that the humans aren't going to add their own sort of editorial judgment for the most part. They can really get creative with the style. You can actually turn up the dial on the snark, for instance. One of the things that the robots do, the so-called robots, let's call them bots instead of robots, one of the things they do is they'll write recaps of Yahoo fantasy football games. This is something that no human journalist would do, but a bot can do it no problem. It writes it in a really snarky style. It might make fun of you for drafting two kickers in your draft and say, hey, this is American football, not soccer. But they're not really journalists either because they don't go out and do reporting. They don't gather original data. And so their output is only as good as the data that goes in there. And that's why I'm not afraid of a robot journalist stealing my job, because really when it comes down to it, as you pointed out, the stuff that the bots can do is stuff that humans may have done in the past, but it wasn't stuff we really liked doing anyway. You know, it was those formulaic crime briefs. It's stuff that humans have never done before, like the fantasy football recaps. And so those are the kinds of things it'll do really well. It's not going to review the new Disney movie.
Yeah, it probably could, but it's not going to. I mean, would you collaborate with a robot in your daily work?
I absolutely would, because, you know, they can do things, certain things, much better than any human can. If they're going to scan through an enormous data set and look for correlations, they could probably come up with stuff that you would never think of. So one realm in which this type of software is being used is the sort of personal fitness quantified self. You know, you use a health tracker, you use your fitness band when you go out running. Well, this type of software can look through your huge data set and say, you know, when you get out of bed at 9:30 a.m., you actually end up, burning 30% fewer calories by the end of the day than when you get out of bed at 8:30. That's something you wouldn't have found by going through the data. I would love to work with a bot that can go through, draw out those kind of insights, maybe turn them into some basic prose, but then the human's job is to make them relatable. It's to put it in a frame of reference that human readers can understand, maybe add a little creativity, maybe make it fun. The bot can't do everything, but it certainly can do some things very well.
And maybe not have to sit through some of those boring press conferences on earnings, say, quarterly. Will Oremus is a senior technology writer at Slate. He joined me here in our New York studio. Thanks so much, Will.
Thanks for having me.
Now, if a piece of software can write a lead or a snarky recap of your fantasy football team's last game, could it also write a think piece, a poem, even a novel? That's what we'll be talking about next with two computer scientists who've been trying to coax machines to do a few of the things we consider most human. Tell a story, think metaphorically, even tell a joke. Let me introduce them now. Mark Riddell is director of the Entertainment Intelligence Lab at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, where he's been working on a story-generating bot called Scheherazade. Welcome to Science Friday, Mark.
Thanks, my pleasure.
And Tony Veal is a senior lecturer in computer science and informatics at University College Dublin in Ireland. He's the force behind the metaphor-generating Twitter bot, Metaphor Magnet. Welcome, Tony.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So we can build a news bot that is convincing, we've learned, but is the bot being creative when it writes that article, Mark?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because we don't really have a really good definition for what it means to be creative. A lot of people, when they think about creativity, they think of this intentional, effortful work that you try to do to create something that's going to be novel, aesthetically pleasing to people. So think of Shakespeare, or telling a bedtime story, making up a bedtime story for your child. These might be thought of as creative sorts of things. But there's actually kind of a flip side to creativity. There's another type of creativity which I think of as kind of an everyday sort of creativity. I sometimes refer to it as creativity with a little c. Which is kind of the everyday sort of thing that you do that's very creative that you don't actually think about. So it's things like making a pun in the middle of a conversation or putting together a tool to get a toy wedged from out from your couch. And so, if you want to talk about big C, then we need a lot of work that's going to have to go into this far beyond what these journalism bots are going to do. But if you think of computers trying to strive for these kind of everyday little C creativity, then I would say these bots are already doing things that are creative, and that we have made a lot of progress along those lines.
Tony, what do you think about this question, big C or little C creativity?
Oh, definitely we're working on little C creativity, but there's a lot of scope there. It's the creativity that humans exhibit every day, and it really is the most interesting kind of creativity. We can all be creative in the little C way, and computers can help us to be more creative in a little C way by being creative themselves. So it's not about replacing human creativity in any sense, but by fostering human creativity, by giving humans tools that encourage them to be creative by being creative in their own way.
Did you think, Tony, that it's possible for a machine, though, to be creative close to the way that a novelist or a human poet might be creative?
Oh, absolutely. If you look in the self-help section of a bookstore on books to be creative, you know, The Dummy's Guide to Creativity or whatever, you'll find that they're full of processes and methods and strategies and step-by-step plans. And in computer science, we call those algorithms. So we're simply mechanizing what people already do. So we're doing an engineering approach to experimental psychology by trying to build things using insights about humans and then demonstrating that those insights are correct, because what the computer generates is considered to be creative or at least novel and useful by its audience, its followers, say, on Twitter.
Hmm. So Mark, you've been working on a story-generating bot. It's called Scheherazade. What kind of stories does your bot write?
Yeah, so Scheherazade is a fictional story writer. So unlike the other things we heard about earlier, Scheherazade tries to make up every part of the aspect of the story, from the characters to the things that they do. So these are stories that have never existed in the real world, don't use real world sort of data. And Scheherazade focuses specifically on telling stories about typical everyday sorts of situations. So things like going to a restaurant, catching an airplane, going on a date. We've actually even tried bank robberies just to kind of have a little bit of fun with this. And there are two notable things that Scheherazade does that I think are kind of interesting. So first of all, it's able to tell stories about virtually any topic that you might ask it to do. And the second of all is that we have reached the point where it is capable of telling stories that are nearly equivalent in this fictional sense to handwritten stories.
You have an example of a movie date story that I've read, and actually I think you can take a look at it on our website, sciencefriday.com/bots. It's a very accurate description of what a movie date might be like, Mark. It's not the most exciting read, I have to say.
No. So when Scheherazade sets out, any computer program has to know what is success. What does success mean? And for Scheherazade, it is telling a story that you would look at, you would read, and say, yeah, I could imagine that might have happened on any day to a particular person. So the story you're talking about involves, you know, characters showing up at the theater, getting their tickets, buying popcorns, finding their seat, turning off their cell phones, so on and so forth.
And we have to take a break. I don't want to give away the end because it is an exciting end to this date. We're going to talk more about computer-generated storytelling with Mark and Tony coming up in just a couple minutes. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Earlier in the hour, we heard how algorithms are transforming the news business, generating finance and sports articles in just seconds. But do humans still have a lock when it comes to fiction? Is storytelling what makes us human, or could a computer just write that novel? We're talking with two computer scientists whose research asks just those questions. Mark Riddell is a director of Entertainment Intelligence Lab at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. His story-generating bot is called Scheherazade. We've heard a bit about that so far. Tony Veal is a senior lecturer in computer science and informatics at University College Dublin. His metaphor-generating Twitter bot is called Metaphor Magnet. We'll hear from you as well in a few moments. 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Are you scared away by robot authors? Well, Tony, your Twitter bot is called Metaphor Magnet. What's the goal of that bot?
Well, it generates metaphors or ways of looking at the world, because when humans use metaphors, we use them for two purposes. We use them to make the familiar seem strange and poetic, but we also use them to make the strange seem familiar and to understand abstractions in concrete terms. So what metaphor bots do is they generate thought-provoking juxtapositions that try to make you think in new ways, or at least to look at the other side of the cliche, to look beyond cliche. So, in effect, they're AI versions of techniques that people like Bill Burroughs in the 60s, Brian Geisen, and the Surrealists used to use, but with reasoning and with world knowledge and the kinds of things that Mark was talking about, all piled in so the system can generate its own perspectives and evaluate them as being meaningful and interesting.
Can you give us maybe a few examples of some metaphor magnet tweets that you've put out?
Sure. So the output is somewhat diverse. So here's a name-dropping one that uses a topical name. So it recently tweeted, "What if Star Trek were real? Barack Obama could be its Mr. Spock. Logical yet aloof and overly rational, too." Okay, so it doesn't really know Barack Obama, so it doesn't intend to insult a real person, but its knowledge of these characters allows it to construct this kind of comparison that people might find interesting. Another one it tweeted recently. Sorry, did you want to say something?
No. I'd like to hear another one.
Okay, so here's another format that it uses. It's a bit of the Sesame Street format. It says, take five of the most intrusive things. 1, wiretaps. 2, search warrants. 3, catheters. 4, burglars. 5, Julian Assange. And it has hashtagged that one, espionage. So I like this one because it puts wiretaps and Julian Assange into the same tweet and calls them both equally intrusive.
And people follow this Twitter bot. And there's quite a following that you have here.
Well, a really interesting thing about Twitter bots is that people follow them because they are robots. They're not interested in systems that pretend to be humans. They're not interested in being fooled by AI. They really want the machine's perspective on human concepts, but they value the fact that it's a machine and it's detached and cold and logical. And so you really have a great stage, a showcase for AI with Twitter bots. People do like the fact that it's a machine.
So, Mark, why do we need computers, though, to tell stories or generate metaphors? We've been doing this for thousands of years. Don't we do a pretty good job ourselves?
Oh, yes. Humans are masters when it comes to storytelling. Matter of fact, storytelling is kind of hardwired into the way we think about the world, how we communicate to each other, explain, inform, and share ideas and thoughts with each other. And that's exactly why we need computers to think about this, because when you think about computers, they're fundamentally not living in the same world we are. They don't understand it when we try to communicate in terms of stories. They don't try to tell us stories to entertain us or to inform us in those sorts of ways. They're kind of grounded in this world of facts. And so I think in the long run, if we ever want these computers to really feel natural to us, so think about the way you interact with Siri now and maybe the way you might want to interact with Siri in the future, then they should kind of live in the same world of stories and understand what we try to mean and through our metaphors and through the little vignettes we want to tell. And there's also kind of a second kind of more applied purpose to looking at storytelling bots, which is there are many practical applications. So aside from entertainment and computer games, if you think about training scenarios or educational vignettes for K-12 education, you might want to immerse learners and trainees in these virtual worlds in which kind of realistic, plausible sorts of things are happening around them and leading them to encourage them to do practice of activities of skills and to get engaged with learning material.
It's about very quickly generating 1,000 plot scenarios, right?
Sure. The more you can generate, the more opportunities you would have to actually engage in these learning worlds.
But Mark, I'd like you to get at something that Tony just talked about, though. One of the draws to Twitter bots is that people like to see something written by a cold, calculating machine that's not a human. When we talk about the creative output that you're trying to get at with these machines, are you trying to tune it to be as close to what humans might make as possible? Or is there something innately wonderful about keeping the machine quality in there, about making it something that we just couldn't come up with because, you know, we're just humans and we can't have anywhere near as much stuff in our heads as a computer can?
Right. Well, I think it's what you're trying to achieve. So there's some pleasure to be derived from these artificial intelligence toys. And part of the pleasure you derive is when they fail. And it's kind of like an improv when the actors kind of screw up. That's kind of a funny moment. But for certain applications, I think for serious applications like training and education, you really don't want to kind of make some very simple mistakes. So if you're trying to tell a story about, going to a restaurant, if that's the situation you're in, you don't want to kind of pull people out of the moment because you made a mistake because they ordered their drink before they sat down, for example.
What do you think about this idea, Tony, about how close you want reality in creativity generated by machines to be to a human experience? Or do we want to make sure that we retain a little bit of what computers are able to uniquely bring to the creative process?
Oh, I think so. Mark is absolutely right in that we need the computers to live in the same world, which means that they have to have facts about stereotypical scripts and behaviors of humans. But the computer can bring its own perspective, its own logical perspective. And if you think about, let's say, where news bots are going, what can a metaphor-generating or a story-generating machine bring to a news bot? Well, I imagine a news bot that could sense the irony in a particular event and frame the story that highlights the irony, or detect hypocrisy in what someone is saying at a particular time, a politician, say, or to generally to summarize a political position with a metaphor. These things can really, in the future, we're not talking right now, but in the future, they can add tremendously to this notion of a newsbot, but at the same time, not pretend to be a human. So people don't like to be suckered by machines pretending to be human, but they will appreciate a machine being a machine, and we'll even tolerate its mistakes when they feel it is a machine making a good faith effort to describe their world.
Topher from Hartford, Connecticut has a question. Topher, go ahead. You're on the show.
I'm curious what your guests think about the issue of copyright. Who owns the creative output of a writing automaton, especially considering, you know, no two creative outputs are going to be the same from two different machines, so to speak, same as individuals. And nobody may care now, but who knows who the next great fake novelist will be.
That's right. You got to give the Pulitzer to somebody. What do you say, Mark?
Well, I think we're treading into unknown territory here in that I'm not sure that people have really kind of figured out what the law should be. Now, in some cases, we've seen situations where the programmer of bots have been responsible for the activity of the bots if they've insulted or slandered or lied. So in one aspect, you might wonder if the copyright would go back to the programmer of the computer. But then, you know, the programmer is not involved in every single detail of the creation. You know, maybe that's actually not the right thing for it to do.
A last question for both of you very quickly. Mark, I'll ask you first. Do you think that in our lifetimes, a machine will generate a compelling piece of fiction, a novel, a great novel?
Within our lifetimes, a compelling piece of novel? I'm not entirely sure that'll happen. There's a lot of things that go into storytelling, a lot of things that you just have to know, from the simple basic facts of how to go to a restaurant to the little things, how to use a credit card, to the big patterns, you know, what makes something dramatic. Why counterposing two things, two activities might make things suspenseful. And each of these is a really kind of a hard problem from a research perspective to figure out and to figure out how to get all this information into a computer system. So we're making small little steps, but you know, as to whether we'll see a fully generated fiction, and I should say without any sort of human intervention, without humans kind of programming in the knowledge up front.
Sure.
I'm a little bit dubious.
Tony, just 30 seconds, what do you say?
I'm skeptical too, but I think that a computer will generate a really compelling joke, a joke that humans would be happy to spread and to share, to even take credit for. And I think that would be an achievement, and I think we're near that. We're talking five years, maybe.
five years away from the Holy Grail.
Humor is tough. It's tough.
It's really. They always say comedy is the hardest thing to write. Tony Veal is a senior lecturer in computer science and informatics at University College Dublin. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And Mark Riddell is director of the Entertainment Intelligence Lab at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you so much. You can read a story generated by Scheherazade and check out more of Metaphor Magnet's tweets at our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/bots. Next up, this is a very special year for enthusiasts of the constant pi, because tomorrow, March 14th, 2015, written in abbreviated form, approximates pi, not just to the usual three digits, 3.14, but to five digits, 3.1415. You'll have to wait another 100 years for that to happen again. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to celebrate. Don't worry, we won't go as far as Archimedes, who actually died for pi, or at least for his circle studies. How are you celebrating Pi Day this year? Maybe baking up something good? Give us a call, 844-724 8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Ian Stewart is an emeritus professor of mathematics at the University of Warwick in England. He's author of Professor Stewart's Incredible Numbers and Professor Stewart's Casebook of Mathematical Mysteries. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Stewart.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the program.
So what is it about pi that is so attractive and beguiling to math geeks?
It's a remarkably interesting and unusual number. It's the one we meet at school and think this is a very strange number. And it comes out of something so straightforward, a circle. And, you know, it's given a circle, if you know the diameter, how big is the circumference? How long is the curve? And it's pi times the diameter. You say, well, what's pi? And at school, we're often told, well, it's 3 1/7. It's 22 over 7. But that's not quite correct. That's actually very slightly too big, because that's 3.1428. And as you already said, pi is a little bit smaller than that.
So who first came up with this idea of pi in the first place?
The idea of pi in its current form goes back to around the 1700s, but the concept without the name and the symbol goes right back to the ancient Greeks, definitely to Archimedes. Archimedes proved a whole lot of things about pi, and he really proved them. He did it, you know, the Greeks were quite hot on logic, and Archimedes did this geometrically. It can go back a bit further. I think even the ancient Babylonians, for example, probably had this. They knew that basically if once you knew how what the ratio of the circumference to the diameter was for one circle, it was the same for all of them. But it was Archimedes who really pinned it down. And among other things, Archimedes proved that there is a single number which gives you that ratio. It's the same for all circles. And it is very slightly less than 3 1/7. He proved it was somewhere between 3 10/71 and 3 1/7. And he did this by considering 96-sided polygons. So it was clever stuff for that period.
Very clever stuff indeed.
Yeah.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking with Ian Stewart. We've got an excerpt of his book and our pop quiz, Pi versus Pi, at our website, sciencefriday.com/pi. Very quickly, before we move on from Archimedes, could you tell us the story about how he may have died for pi?
Yeah, the story is that he was pretty old. He lived quite a long time, and he was drawing a mathematical diagram with circles in the sand, which is kind of how they did it. Instead of a blackboard, they would draw in the sand. Well, he was in Alexandria at the time. He was in Egypt, so there's probably quite a bit of sand around. And a shadow fell across his diagram, and he just sort of shouted at the person who was causing this, you know, get off my diagram. Unfortunately, it was an invading Roman soldier who took his sword out and killed him. And there's no clear documentary evidence. A historian would say this is, you know, it's just a story. But to a mathematician, this does ring true to some extent, that somebody as good at math as Archimedes and as fascinated by it would be so immersed in his new theorem, his new diagram, that he really would not notice that it was an invading Roman soldier.
Oh, my goodness, what a story. Let's go to the phone. Steve is actually calling from California here. Hi there, Steve. You're on Science Friday.
Hey, hi. Good to hear you.
Good to hear from you. How are you celebrating Pi Day this year?
So my fiancé and I were looking to pick a date that was meaningful, both easy to remember and meaningful for us. We're a couple of nerds, and so we decided to actually have our wedding tomorrow.
My goodness, you're getting married tomorrow just because it's Pi Day?
Well, not just because it's Pi Day.
I mean, obviously, you know, you love each other and everything.
In 2015, it's going to be, you know, the more significant digits of pi available for our wedding. So we said, hey, let's go ahead and get married on 3/14/15.
Well, congratulations. I have to ask. I just assume that you're not cutting a wedding cake. You're cutting pie.
There will be pie to cut. Yeah.
There will be pie to cut. Hey, congratulations, Steve. Thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ian, I have to ask you, in England, do you guys even celebrate Pi Day the same day as us? I guess not, right?
No, because we put the day before the month, so it's 14.3 to us, and that's, I'm sure there's something very interesting about 14.3 or 143, but I have no idea what it is, actually, in that case. So you can't, the best you can do is, I guess, would be the 3rd of January 2041, which would be 3141. So if we wait another 26 years, we will get a sort of British Pi Day. Well, Pi Year. Pi Century. It'll happen. It won't happen again until 2141.
Well, we're going to continue celebrating Pi Day. The Pi Party will continue with Ian Stewart coming up in just a few minutes right after this. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. We're in the middle of our annual pie party with our special guest, Ian Stewart. He's an emeritus professor of mathematics at the University of Warwick in England, and he's the author of Professor Stewart's Incredible Numbers. We're also going to take some more of your phone calls at 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK, finding out how you are celebrating this Pi Day. Pi, of course, the most famous irrational number, Ian, but it was not the first irrational number.
No, that's right. The first irrational number, that is a number that can never be represented by an exact fraction with two whole numbers. The first one was the square root of 2, which when they discovered this was again the ancient Greeks, it's even earlier than Archimedes. He was about 250 BC, whereas square root of 2 being irrational goes back to about 550 BC. So we're, you know, more than 2,500 years ago that the mathematicians discovered this. So easiest way to get square root of 2 is you draw a square, a unit square, side 1, whatever units you like, and just look at the diagonal, and that is length root 2. That's by Pythagoras' theorem. We all remember Pythagoras' theorem from school, I'm sure. And it was the Pythagoreans, which is an ancient Greek, it was a mystical cult which was very obsessed with numbers as the key to the universe, which, when you look at modern science, actually that wasn't such a bad idea. But the Pythagoreans, one of them discovered that the square root of 2 was irrational. It was not a fraction. Now, that was bad news to the Pythagoreans, because they thought that all numbers were whole numbers or fractions. And suddenly out comes this geometrical object, the diagonal of a square, for heaven's sake. And you either have to say, well, the length of that is not a number, or you have to say, well, it is a number, but it's not a number of the kind that we recognise as number. So whichever way you go, the philosophy was kind of compromised. So the story is that the chap who did this, his name was Hippasus of Metapontum. He made the mistake of announcing this discovery, probably very excitedly, to fellow Pythagoreans when he was on a boat crossing the Mediterranean. And the extreme version of the story is they were so annoyed that he'd spoilt their philosophy that they picked him up and threw him out of the boat in the middle of the Mediterranean. Again, there's no support for this. I suspect it wasn't quite as bloodthirsty as that, but they probably kicked him out of the cult.
There are some fairly amazing stories behind these numbers that you have, Ian. It is something else. We're talking to people who are celebrating Pi Day, and I just want to hear from Peter in Stoughton, Wisconsin. Hi, Peter.
Good day. I live in Stoughton, Wisconsin, where our postal code is 53589, and so in honor of Pi Day, we're having a Pi run starting this tomorrow at 9:26 in the morning. So you have 3.14159265 3589. So it's our
oh, wow.
our once in a lifetime day around this town.
Peter, thank you so much. Ian, do you run into people all over the world who take pi as seriously as you do?
Well, yeah, I run into lots of mathematicians, and almost all mathematicians think pi is fantastic. But a lot of people find pi fascinating. We did an app which is related to the book, and the app has a million digits of pi, and you can type your birthday in. So birthday would be a six-digit number. And there are 1 million different six-digit numbers. So there's actually a pretty good chance that your birthday is going to fall somewhere in the first million digits of pi. The problem is some numbers get in there twice, so two or three times. But you type your birthday in, and for most people, when you do this, it will say, your birthday is the 537,819th digit of pi onwards. And mathematicians would dearly love to prove that every possible combination of digits occurs somewhere in pi. It's not important. It really doesn't matter. But it would pin down once and for all the feeling that the digits of pi are just completely crazy. They're all over the place. There isn't any real pattern to them as such. They're like a string of random numbers. but they're not random because they're pi, and there's only one pi. So it is kind of fascinating. There's a nice joke about pi. It's a typical mathematician's joke. You may have heard of it, but you know the standard formula for the area of a circle from school, pi r squared.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, pi r squared. No, pi r round. Chocolate r squared.
Yeah, well, we're not going to ask our listeners to share their pie jokes. So this gets to something that you've written about, what we were just talking about how these numbers actually hold a grasp on our consciousness somehow. You write that human numbers themselves are human concepts that model reality, but they are not themselves real. Could you just talk about that idea, that concept for a moment?
Yeah, I mean, pi, I've just talked about a million decimal places of pi. Now, you can make the most perfect real circle that you can imagine making. Some highly technological future civilization makes a circle the size of the solar system, and it's absolutely smooth down to the nearest atom. And then they could measure the circumference of the thing. And I'm not sure how many decimal places it would go to, but it may be 15 or 20. It's nowhere near a million. There's no way you could get down to that kind of accuracy. So the real world doesn't actually have pi in it, in this idealized, perfect, exact form of the infinitely thin, perfectly round circle, calculated to absolute perfect accuracy. So when we think about, but nonetheless, pi is a very useful number. And if, even if I'm an engineer who's making things to do with circles, some sort of decent approximation to pi is actually a very useful number to have. It's no longer considered terribly advanced, but it's good practical stuff. We had somebody who was tiling our bathroom, and he said he was going to do a job, and he actually said to me, there's a formula for the area of a circle, isn't there? And I said, yeah, pi r squared. And he said, well, what's pi? I said, well, it's sort of 3 1/7. Oh, great, he said, because I've got to tile a circular piece of flooring for somebody, and I want to know how many tiles it will take. And if I can work out the area, that will give me a kind of minimum estimate, and add 10% for luck, and probably that'll be right.
Sure.
So here is the man who is tiling our bathroom, who has suddenly found a use for pi.
So?
Yeah. So it's practical, but also it is a human construct. There isn't. You don't need it to a million decimal places. Well, you certainly don't need it to more than that.
And it's practical, and as we found, it's beautiful as well. And I appreciate you sharing some pie stories with us today, Ian Stord. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ian Stord, an emeritus professor of mathematics at the University of Warwick. He's author of Professor Stord's Incredible Numbers. You can read some of the book and our pop quiz, Pi versus Pi, on our website, sciencefriday.com/pi. Speaking of pie crust should be so simple. All you need is flour, a little sugar and salt, butter, shortening, some cold water. But you ask any baker if a pie crust turns out and the same way every time, and you'll probably hear no, it turns out different every time. Before you reach for that ready-made crust, though, we'll teach you how to scientifically perfect your pies in the latest installment of Science Friday's Food Failures series, just in time for Pie Day, of course. Joining me now with his top 3.14 tips or so on how to always make sure you get a flaky crust is J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. He's managing culinary director for the website Serious Eats. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, which is out this September. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good. So first tip, how can we make sure a pie crust always comes out super flaky?
Well, okay, so the first thing to know is to understand how those flakes form. So if you're looking at a pie dough, there's basically three different things in there. There's fat, flour, and water. And those are the three ingredients. But once you actually incorporate those ingredients together, you actually end up with three distinct phases in the dough as well. So you'll end up with pockets of pure fat. You'll end up with a kind of fat and flour paste. And then you'll also end up with flour and water mixture. And those three elements, it's the balance of those three elements that create those flakes. So when you roll out a piece of dough, what you're doing is you're flattening those pockets of fat out into sort of long, thin sheets. And those sheets are alternated with layers of this water and flour mixture. And it's that water and flour mixture that forms gluten, which is, you know, the stuff that gives bread, pizza dough its structure. So that water and flour mixture forms gluten. And meanwhile, the fat kind of melts away. So it ends up separating those water and flour layers with these sort of melty fat layers. And that's what creates the flakes in a good pie crust. But, you know, as you said, it's really, really difficult to strike that right balance, even for a professional pie maker. You know, a professional pie maker, even then, like, you know, 99 out of 100 times it might come out right. But then that one time you accidentally cut in the flour a little bit too much, or you accidentally cut in the flour not quite enough. And that's the part that really throws it off, is cutting the flour, cutting the butter into the flour. Because depending on how much butter is cut in, you're going to end up with different amounts of dry flour remaining. And that's going to require you to add different amounts of water. And that ends up throwing the whole balance off. So, yeah, so the real question is, how do you make it consistent? And what I found back when I was working at Cooks Illustrated is that it's not actually important. So as we said, there are three different phases. Fat, flour and fat paste, and flour and water. The ratio of pure fat to fat flour paste is actually not that important. And in fact, you can make a pie crust entirely out of a fat flour paste and a flour and water mixture. And so, you know, the idea is that you completely eliminate any of the inconsistencies in cutting butter into the flour. So what I do for my pie crust is I'll take half my amount of flour, 100% of my fat, whether it's butter or shortening or combination, and then completely blend that in a food processor into a paste, so that there's no really big clumps of fat remaining like you would have in a traditional pie crust. Once I do that, then I add in the remaining flour and pulse it just enough times to cut that flour to cut the fat flour paste up into little pieces that then kind of intersperse with the flour. So what that process does is it gives you a completely consistent amount of dry flour and fat flour paste every single time, so that your crusts come out exactly the same every single time. It also means that you don't have to guess how much water you're going to add, because, as you know, in traditional pie crust recipes, you're instructed to add water a little bit at a time until the dough just barely comes together. And, you know, unless you're experienced with it, you have to be really good with your hands, you know, really nimbly pimbly with your fingers there. I mean, unless you're experienced with it, it's something that's difficult to gauge. So what this method does is it completely eliminates any of that inconsistency.
And I want to get to another method in a moment. I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now, here's a second trick, and this has to do with adding vodka to dough, not water. Tell us about this.
That's correct. This is another technique that I developed when I was working at Cooks Illustrated, and you can find the recipe in their magazine and on their website. But the basic idea is that once again, it's about controlling gluten formation, and gluten is the thing, is sort of the enemy of pies. You know, you need a little bit of it in order to get those flaky layers, but if you get too much gluten, your pie crust ends up leathery. Or tough. And that, you know, that is really like the number one offense with pie crust that I've seen eating out in restaurants or eating out at bakeries or some unnamed friends' houses, that the pie crusts come out tough or leathery. And that comes from too much gluten development. And so the way gluten is formed is when water and flour combine. So you need water plus flour. So the more water you add to your pie crust, the more gluten you end up forming. So, you know, the trick is with pie crust is you want to add as little water as possible so that you minimize gluten formation. But the problem then becomes that with very little water, a pie crust is very crumbly and very difficult to roll out. The pie dough is very difficult to roll out. So the question was, how do you add liquid to your pie dough while also minimizing gluten formation? And what I discovered was that if you use vodka in place of water, and we're talking just regular old 80-proof vodka, you can actually add more liquid to your pie dough because gluten does not form in ethanol, which, you know, and as you know, vodka is about 60% water, 40% ethanol. So you can add a couple tablespoons extra liquid per given batch of pie dough without really compromising its texture.
Interesting. Okay. Well, so I want to get to one last thing here quickly, and this is just a myth that you're trying to bust here. How much does humidity influence how a pie crust turns out? We just have about 30 seconds.
Very, very little. I made pie crusts in chambers of varying degrees of humidity, all the way from bone dry to almost rainforest wet. And in the amount of time that it takes to make a pie crust, even if it takes you about half an hour to make a pie crust, it absorbs at most about 0.1% of its weight in moisture from the environment. So the even on a very humid day, it's really not going to affect the outcome of your pie crust at all.
Okay, so don't have to put a lot of water in there, but the humidity doesn't really matter. Very interesting stuff.
Doesn't really matter.
Hey, Kenji, happy Pi Day to you.
Thanks, you too.
Kenji Lopez-Ault is Managing Culinary Director at the website Serious Eats. And one last thing before we go. 85 years ago this week, astronomers at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona sent a telegram to Harvard registering their discovery of another planet in our solar system. It was big news. It made the front page in New York, Chicago, and elsewhere. And in London on March 14th, the discovery was breakfast time conversation in the household where 11-year-old Venetia Burney lived. She recalled the moment in a 2006 conversation with NASA.
My grandfather read out at breakfast the great news and said he wondered what it would be called. And for some reason, I, after a short pause, said, why not call it Pluto? I was fairly familiar with Greek and Roman legends from various children's books that I'd read. And, of course, I did know about the solar system and the names the other planets have. And so I suppose I just thought that this was a name that hadn't been used. And there it was.
Well, it turns out that Venetia Burney's grandfather was a well-connected academic. He sent the suggestion to an astronomer friend, Herbert Hall Turner, who declared the name excellent and said that it beat anything suggested at a Royal Astronomical Society meeting. Turner sent a telegram to the Lowell Observatory, which read, naming new planet, please consider Pluto. Suggested by small girl, Venetia Burney, for dark, gloomy planet. Turner. There was a lot of debate over the name, but eventually the observatory scientists voted it unanimously, and Pluto got its official name on May 24th, 1930. Oh, and the Disney dog? That name came a little bit later. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Head to sciencefriday.com to subscribe to our podcasts, audio and video, and you can also join our mailing list. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, Room 412, New York, New York, 10036, or email us scifry@sciencefriday.com. Ira is back next week. In New York, I'm John Dankosky.